Well, I hope you had a chance to digest what we talked about yesterday, and we're going to be building on that this morning. And the overall title of the class, again, is Do You Believe? And we haven't addressed that yet, but I've kind of given a title to each class. And if you wanted to make a title out of today, it would be The Two Seeds. So we're going to examine the purpose verse again. And which was John 20, verse 31, it says, at the end of all of his writings, and there is one chapter after this, which we're going to reference in just a minute, and we'll refer to on Friday. He says that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. And I think that John had a very focused purpose in writing what he wrote. Much more so than I ever realized. I've come to appreciate that he had to leave out quite a bit, which makes what he did say that much more important. And he tells us as much in the next chapter, verse 25. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written, every one, I suppose, that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. And somebody who had contact with the Son of God and all the interactions that he had clearly could say that. From yesterday's class, we saw that John started from his gospel message at the same place as the other gospel writers did. So as you've had time to let that settle in, let's maybe apply that a little bit more as to what was his overall purpose for writing those first two verses that we sometimes have some difficulty in understanding. So if he started with the literal birth of Christ, this gospel account is devoted to demonstrating who Christ was from his beginning, which was a very vital point for him. I've got here on the phrase Big John. That's what my uncle used to call the Gospel of John. It's Big John. John's message is to provide a contrast between the two seeds that were prophesied in Genesis, the third chapter. And isn't it ironic how brother overlap, and Brother Dick talked about this particular verse this morning in his class. It is fitting that John commences with the conception of the seed of the woman, that divine seed that was the promised to bruise the serpent's head. So it makes very much sense to me from the taking a step back and looking at it at face value, this is where he would have started. Because this is the tension. When I say the whole book of John refers to Genesis 3, it's really in this context. It's the battle between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. I'm going to come back to this question in just a second, but if you had to say in your mind how many times that the Jews sought to kill Jesus, how many times would you guess that that occurs in John's writing? We'll answer that in just a moment. So, as you all know, the most basic and primary prophecy in all the scriptures would be Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, and it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. It is this promised seed that John wants us to make sure we understand. This is who was prophesied. This is who we were looking forward to. And once the prophecy has come to pass, you know that it has been fulfilled. And I wanted to go through a few quick slides, and the next five or six slides are really a condensation or a condensing, I should say, of a class on prophecy in itself. But I think these are some of the salient points when we talk about prophecy, that we're on the sound footing of these prophetical principles. So a quick review, that prophecy must have two components. And from the Old Testament, we gain these. And even from the writings of John, you can see Christ applying these principles when he gives a prophecy to his disciples or to others. And I think that it's interesting, you kind of think about it in two senses. One would be a future teller, or somebody who tells something beforehand, and two, a truth teller, or a foreteller, to tell the truth required by God. And as we know that from Isaiah 46, 9 through 10, that only God has the ability to tell the end, the beginning, the end from the beginning. So that is unique to God, and that's why we look at future telling as a definite test, as is this a spirit or a teaching from God. So we know minimally from prophecy that the purpose is to warn the wayward. We see this consistently throughout the Old Testament and the Israelites. It was to encourage the faithful. It was to vindicate God. It was to vindicate His messenger. And it was to vindicate His message. So these are elements of prophecy that we need to make sure that we recognize. And similarly, the purpose wasn't just to future tell. That's what we need to make sure we don't get caught up in, is the future telling. And if you look at Deuteronomy 13 and Deuteronomy 18, which we're not going to take the time to do that today, it's showing that we're both of these elements have to be there. It can't be one or the other. It has to be both. And prophecy was to be an engine of faith. Once the event was passed and fulfilled as predicted, you could have confidence in the rest of the messages, prophet's message. Again, when it is in agreement with the rest of God's utterances. The hearer could change their ways and heed the message when its moral imperatives, which always agreed with utterances of God. And if you get in the slides later, those are the references in Deuteronomy that are most applicable. So if we apply this to what John is understanding as fulfilled prophecy in the Messiah, the promised seed, we see from this point forward, in Genesis 3, we have the great controversy of Scripture, which is the conflict of the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And John picks up this controversy and says, you need to apply this to Christ. You need to make sure that you understand what has been fulfilled before your very eyes, because both aspects were fulfilled in Christ. The future telling as well as the truth telling in the promised seed. And the next few verses or slides that we're going to talk about will show sort of the global nature in which this great controversy is talked about throughout the Scriptures. We see that there are two seeds in Isaiah 1 and 4. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers. Children that are corruptors, that have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger. They are gone away backward. Isaiah 41, 8 through 9, in contrast to that, but thou, Israel, art my servant. Jacob I have chosen. The seed of Abraham, my friend, thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and have called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, thou art my servant. I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Similarly, in Romans 9, verses 6 through 8, it says, for they are not all Israel which are of Israel, neither because they are the seed of Abraham they are called the children, but in Isaac shall thy seed be called, that is, they which are the children of the flesh. These are not the children of God, but the children of promise are counted for the seed. So this emphasis on the seed is over and over throughout the Scriptures. And in fact, one of the great purposes of the Old Testament, I think this is one that we might not give enough attention to, is Malachi 2:15. And did he not make one? The whole purpose of marriage, that yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one that he might seek a godly seed. And obviously, I wouldn't be quoting this if it didn't have application to John's writing. The whole third chapter of John is really in reference to this, for sure, of the first epistle. But we'll read just these two verses. Whosoever is born of God doth not commit a sin, for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin, because he is born of God. In this the children are manifest in the children of the devil. So here we see the two seeds, the children of God and how they're manifested, and the children of the devil. And I'll pause right here. I'll get a slide later on, but I want you to make sure that you recognize that John is a very contrasting style in his writing. He consistently puts out the two different options, whether it's the children of God or the children of the devil. It's light or darkness, truth or evil. over and over and over again, he draws this line for us. He tries to help give us the example of what is true and in accordance with God and the other. So here it makes sense, again, that he's focusing on these two seeds and how important it is for us to grasp who Christ really was. So the children of the devil would be, whosoever doeth not the righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother. So those are two definitions or tests, if you will, of those who are not the children of God. Similarly, we see that this theme, this golden thread of the truth, goes all the way from Genesis into Revelation 12:17. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and he went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which kept the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And we understand from Isaiah 65, verses 22 through 25, this is the final promise. It contains this aspect of the seed. It says, "And they shall not build and another inhabit it. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree, there are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. And they shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble. For they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord." And that's a reference to Christ. And obviously we hope that we each are a part of that seed. We pray that we are. "And their offspring with them. And it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. And while they are yet speaking, I will hear. And the wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion and the straw shall eat like the bullock. And the dust shall be the serpent's meat. And they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. So the serpent has been tamed, and it is no longer the great controversy at that point in time." So going back to Genesis 3:15, we see the demonstration of both elements of prophecy. There's the future telling, the fact that the promised seed would come and take away the curse and the consequence of it, the serpent's lie and their disobedience. They have failed to trust in believing in what God had said from the beginning. And think about that in relationship to what you read in the Gospel of John. We have those who are telling a lie about who Christ is, and they're not believing what God is trying to tell them. They are making, in effect, God a liar. The truth-telling, so, would be reference to the promise of deliverance from death eternally. And the power of the serpent would be destroyed. The serpent's words could only bring death, not life. So, just to come back to this idea of John laying out a case before us, the word he uses the word witness 21 times. So this also helps to build the case that he is trying to lay out for us a very detailed understanding of this is why you should understand Christ for who he is, because this was a significant argument in the first century among the Jews. And he uses this word, I think, very intentionally, and I think he's picked out different points of contact which would be verifiable and would be easy for others to see. Yes, I see how this individual was from God, how there's a contrast to those that acted differently than this individual did. And like we talked about yesterday, there's birth of Christ, to where there was signs in heaven, there was the opening up of the heavens. But then there's John and John the Baptist and how he was pointing forward. He clearly says that he wasn't the light, but he was pointing forward to the light. And Brother Vest pointed out to me a point that I hadn't recognized before. They said there's some references that some suggest that John was written for those who followed John the Baptizer, that he was his followers needed to be convinced that Christ was who he said he was. And really, there is quite a bit of reference to John in the Gospel of John. So that's an interesting point to consider. So John is laying out the case for the proper understanding of the gospel. I'm sorry, understanding of God provided seed prophesied from the beginning. Now, the next chart that I'm going to put up, it shows Christ's dependence on God. And we made reference to this already. Just like every other father, the Son would not be in existence or who he was without their father. So their very character and their existence are dependent on their father. Now, you have to really look at this chart long and appreciate it because it took a long time. Now, we won't spend a whole lot of time on this. This is really more for your study. But there are 8 columns and 10 rows, or however it is. I don't know which one. There's 80 references here. These are the ones that I glean from reading the Gospel of John that show Christ's dependence on his Father. So I suggest to you that he is going out of his way to demonstrate that he was not God. He was the Son of God. And that's an important point because that was part of the controversy. There was the pushing of the point that he was making himself God. We looked at one of the references in John 10:31 yesterday. And that we're going to look at that a little bit more in depth here in terms of the epistles and why that point would be necessary. So if you're getting the slides, you don't have to worry about writing those down, but that's, I think, very, very interesting and hopefully a little bit more powerful when you see all those references up there. John not only provides witness as to the seed of the woman, who the seed of the woman is, but also the seed of the serpent. And so I asked you this question already, so I'll tell you, before I had really considered this question as to how many times they would have sought to kill Jesus, I would have said maybe 4 or 5. Is that, who? Huh? Half a dozen. Well, in fact, it's about 40 times. So, and this is a point I had missed. So, in fact, John goes out of his way to demonstrate who the seed of the serpent was. And this is not an insignificant point because John is the only writer in the New Testament that refers to something called the Antichrist. He refers to it in 1 John and he refers to it in 2 John. And I would suggest to you, we're going to try to show this in just a minute, but just so you get the concept, that he doesn't use the word Antichrist in the gospel, but the Antichrist, those who are anti-Messiah, are all throughout the entire gospel. They sought to kill the Messiah. They were anti his message because God's truth did not reside in them. These are the references. I didn't have time to put it in a pretty chart like the last one. So if you find others, let me know. Those are the times that it talks about them either seeking to kill Christ or stone him or so forth. I've got just a couple of them listed out here. Sought to kill Jesus, verse 16 of chapter 5. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. And we quoted this one yesterday, and I got a little bit more there than just verse 31. And the Jews took up stone again to stone him. Jesus answered them, "Many good works have I shown you from my Father. From which of those works do you stone me?" The Jews answered him, saying, "For a good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, because thou, being a Jew, being a man, makest thyself God." And obviously we know that he says he's the Son of God, and they make an important extrapolation. They push the point and say, well, if you say that, then you're saying you're God. And that's a point that's not insignificant for us individually, is that we sometimes, I know I've done this, you say, well, if you say that, then you definitely are saying this. And that's not what happened here. You have to be careful that you don't push the point too far, because they did in their own self-righteousness, and it was to their own destruction. We have to be careful of that, brothers and sisters. And I think there are other little points like that all throughout John's gospel that illustrate sort of the thinking of the flesh, the spirit of the circumcision, and points where we have to be careful in terms of seeking God's truth in spirit and in truth. So the serpent's lie continues, even though they did kill Christ, and ultimately we know that that was God's will to fulfill his purpose. He allowed it to happen. I would suggest that the end of this pronunciation, this condemnation of saying that Christ was God didn't stop at this point. So if we look at 2 John, and again, this is a condensed lecture. I think I gave this here 3 or 4 years ago. Hopefully you're all safely forgotten it by now. And this will feel like new material. But it's good review either way. John, out of this little bitty linked letter, makes one big point. And the point here is in reference to Antichrist. Verses 7 through 9, because many deceivers went out into the world, those not confessing Jesus Christ to have come in the flesh. This is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Watch yourselves that we may not lose those things which we have worked out, but that we may receive a full reward. Everyone transgressing and not abiding in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. The one abiding in the doctrine of Christ is the one, this one has the Father and the Son. So this is a very interesting passage on multiple levels. But some of the things that we glean just on the surface says the deceivers had already gone out into the world. So this is something that was already happening in John's day. Not something that's future. That's something we would deal with people who have a differing view on who or what the Antichrist is. Their deception was teaching that Christ did not come in the flesh. And if you remember back to yesterday, John 1:14, it says that he was made flesh. This is where it starts to become interesting to connect these things. Antichrist is defined as, quote, those not confessing Jesus Christ to have come in the flesh. And verse 8 would indicate that this teaching is not what John taught, and it would affect your reward by believing in this or their deception. And number 5, lastly, if you do not continue in the doctrine of Christ, you do not have God. And I think when you look at that word doctrine of Christ, or the phrase doctrine of Christ, it could be taken in two cases, senses. And I think I always understood it as the teaching of Christ. And I think that is a definite way we should understand it. But the way it seems John is writing it, it seems as though it's the teaching about Christ, his nature, is really the main message or the main thing that had to be on the minds of those in the first century as to what would have been deception to the first century believers. If you use eSword, which I highly recommend, it's a great free program to help find things in the concordance. If you look up Antichrist, this is what you would get. There's only these references. And we see that it only occurs in 1 John, two times in the second chapter, once in the fourth chapter, and once in chapter the second epistle. If you search it plural with S, it only occurs once in the second chapter. Now, there are other references to false messiahs or false Christ. And if you want to look more into Antichrist, I recommend the pamphlet that Brother James, and I believe it was Rick, did? Bill did several years ago. There's a lot more in-depth study into Antichrist there. But I would suggest to you, like I did several years ago, is that Antichrist, I think, is actually something that we need to not only be more aware of because of the current environment, but I think this is one of our last potentials to teach others outside of our faith the gospel message. Because you probably, like I do, have a hard time getting someone to engage in a meaningful discussion. And the Antichrist is something that people are aware of. They have a concept of it. And it's an opportunity to bring them back to the Bible and start to reason with them from the Scriptures. Those weren't many Scriptures to go through. So this is a little bit of an aside, but I would suggest that you really need to think about it in those terms. And I'll make a little handout available, which we can put on the CDs, that is maybe about 3 or 4 pages that would be something you could hand to somebody and be familiar with yourself in terms of a preaching tool to someone about who or what Antichrist is. So these passages that refer to Antichrist, I've got listed here. Maybe we won't take the time to read each one of them, but I think you get the sense that John is this is a significant point. He's dealing with this Antichrist issue in the first epistle as well as the second epistle. He comes back and writes another epistle because of this issue. That's really the main thrust of 2 John. And we see clearly from the second chapter of the first epistle that they are even now. So that it was already present at the time. And those who were antichrist were denying, saying that Jesus is not the Christ. So we want to examine this idea of flesh for just a minute, a little bit more in depth. So what does John and the other New Testament writers mean when they say flesh? Well, there are two principal meanings of flesh in the New Testament. One would be a human being, a person, flesh and blood. That's me standing here before you. And two would be human nature. Obviously, that would be our propensity to sin, our ability to have what humans have common, which is sin-stricken nature. And we can look at just I got a few examples here. We don't necessarily have to read each one of them, but we can see that there is reference in this column here to flesh being used as a person, and this column will be reference to human nature. And I'll just read number one from each one of them. And answering, Jesus said unto him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood did not reveal it to you, but my Father in heaven." And on the other side, referring to human nature, thinking about the word flesh, "Watch and pray that you do not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is eager, but the flesh is weak." So how do we determine which flesh is meant in both of those cases? Well, it would be obviously through context and the purpose of the writing, the context of the writing, and then we apply both of them. So, let me see. Yeah. So if we consider, and this is the verses preceding those ones that refer to the Antichrist, chapter 2, verses 15 to 17, I think I put on a different set of lenses when I looked at this as to the context of how he transitions into this idea. Why did he even start thinking about Antichrist in the way he wrote this? It says, "Do not love the world," and think about what we talked about yesterday, who could the world be there? I think oftentimes we think about that in a very global sense, but could it be a much more narrow sense in terms of the Jewish world and those who were seeking their own preeminence, their own followers? Think about that as we read through these verses. "Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Because all that which is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and its lusts. But the one doing the will of God abides forever." And then the next verse, he starts talking about the Antichrist, those who are anti-Messiah. So the context of the writing, not unlike what we just talked about in the Gospel of John, there was no denial that Jesus existed as a human being. There was never an argument of those that opposed Christ and the apostles. In one verse, you could look at many, I guess, but this one is probably the most helpful. Acts 5:28 says they were commanding the apostles not to teach in Christ's name. And he says, "And behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring on us the blood of this man," which was rightly so. But so there was no denial that he was a man. It's that they say very, very clearly here that the blood of this man, that they were referring to him as a person. They didn't deny that. So what were they denying? There was no disputing that Christ was a living and breathing individual. Why did they dispute arise over his nature? Well, part of the answer is apparent in the way John writes his passage about Antichrist. He tells us that it is a deliberate attempt to deceive people about Christ, meaning the Jews. And it says, "Because many deceivers went out into the world." I'm going to go ahead and just flip through that. So why would anybody teach that Christ didn't come in the flesh?
Because
Well, for Jewish leaders to keep their followers, it would make sense for their position make sense for them to poison their minds against Christ, which was their position. They wanted to poison Christ as a teaching and following of Christ. And there would be no doctrine more ingrained in the Jewish mind than Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. So if you say something that is completely outrageous and no Jew would agree with, then you're going to have more ability to try to pull that person into what you want to have as far as a following and a camp. And we're not going to take the time to read all these next few slides, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any means, but the New Testament is absolutely filled with this conflict that is happening with the Jews, Christ, and the apostles. And the deception that was intended is striking. And some of the next slides show that. Acts 20, verses 28 through 31. Then take heed to yourselves and all the flock in which the Holy Spirit placed you as overseers, to shepherds, the assembly of God which he purchased through his own blood. For I know this, that after my departure, grievous wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And out of yourselves will rise up men speaking perverted things in order to draw away the disciples after themselves. This was their intention. Because of this, watch, remembering that I did not cease admonishing each one with tears night and day for 3 years. That was Paul speaking. John 5 and 8, I'm sorry, we're not going to spend much time on this. These are the two references that we've already referred to, but this would have been the accusation of the Jews making, they were taking that step of saying, if you say you're the Son of God, then you're making yourself God, you're making yourself equal to God, and that's their concept. They didn't have room for Christ in their construct, something we all have to be careful of. In Titus chapter 1, holding fast the faithful word as he hath been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convince the gainsayers, for there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcision. And the circumcision is outlined very clearly in the book of Acts. The spirit of the circumcision shows what they did to the ecclesias in the first century. They definitely caused division, in contrast to what Brother Dick was talking about yesterday, all the growth and development, which I look at as the fruit of Christ's ministry was coming to bear after his resurrection. You see this the brothers and sisters growing in great number, and they are together in peace and unity. And it is obviously the flesh can do a lot of damage, and it was helped by they of the circumcision. I won't take the time to read the next one references. There's Ephesians 4:14, Romans 16 verses 17 and 18. And by way of kind of concluding this section here, it says the Jewish leaders tried to turn many Jews from Christ based on their false interpretations of Christ. This was for their own purpose of gaining followers for themselves. It was their doctrine that was confusion to the Gentiles, but ultimately, I'm sorry, this is a question. Was it their doctrine that was confusion to the Gentiles, ultimately picked up by their polytheistic background? So this really could have been the beginning of what we have today as the belief of the Trinity. Or, you know, obviously it's not unique. There are polytheistic, but it makes you wonder if this isn't how it got into the Christian faith so easily. It appears possible that it was this doctrine of the deity of Christ that John was warning and teaching against. It's obvious that it was not some future individual that is to come, and that's very clear from all the contexts. And again, for the sake of time, we won't read all the next slides, but sometimes because of familiarity, we don't appreciate how many times the New Testament writers refer to Christ as a man, and how he partook of the same, and their reference really is to his human nature. We all recognize that here in Hebrews 2:14. He also himself took part of the same. And what is the same that he's taken part of? Just as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also likewise took part of the same. So we don't have any problem reconciling John chapter 1 anymore, do we? We understand that he was a provided seed by God, but he was the son of Mary, the son of Adam. He was just like as we are, but through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil. That conflict, the great controversy that is from Genesis all throughout Revelation, but it culminates in the person Jesus Christ. So the purpose here is undoubtedly to identify the nature of Christ. Hebrews 5 and 7 says the same thing, who in the days of his flesh, Hebrews 7, for his own first for his own sins, and obviously we know he didn't have any personal sins. Hebrews 9, 11 through 12 says, having obtained eternal redemption, meaning he needed redemption. That word, the word, or the words for us are not in the original, so it's not just for us, it's for himself as well as us. Hebrews 13, 20, through the blood of the everlasting covenant. 1 Peter 3 talks about him being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit. In his own body in chapter 2, according to the flesh in Romans 1 and 3. And we know that Christ obviously refused the title of good because he was made sin for us, as we understand from 2 Corinthians chapter 5. So in summary there, it says, clearly John was not concerned to insist that Jesus actually had a material human body. In our day, there has been a reluctance to believe that Jesus truly and fully shared the weakness of human nature and knew the tug of selfish human desires. John's teaching was that he did have the same flesh common to man. The temptation, which he certainly had to face many a time, is not the same as yielding to temptation, but that would have been sin. The doctrine that makes Jesus a man apart, in the sense of that he bore a higher or nobler nature than his fellows, is what John is trying to guard against and teach against as anti-Christ or anti-Messiah. We can use the truth of Scriptures as a teaching tool, not only for ourselves, but the world around us. They have a concept of Antichrist, but it is not a scripturally sound understanding of Antichrist. Let us use this familiar topic as a means of being preachers of righteousness. And these are the references I won't take the time to read, but these are the active resistance references that show that there was a concerted effort to deceive present in the New Testament. And then I told you that we would look at this slide where it says there's a contrasting style of John, and there's a thesis and an antithesis. He's showing that they're the two opposites throughout his writings. There's light and darkness, truth and lies, good and evil, life and death, righteousness and sin, love and hatred, joy and sorrow, seed of God and the seed of the serpent, which is what we have been considering this morning, fruitfulness and unfruitfulness, obedience and disobedience. These are all found both in John, Gospel of John, as well as the first John. He understood the need to draw a clear line in the appropriate place. In the time we have left, I'm doing better on time by skipping some passages than I thought. I'm sure there's a lot that we haven't gone over. If in the time that we have left this week, if there's something that you wanted to go over that I haven't, don't look like I'm going to address, please let me know today or tomorrow, and I'll see what I can do to fit that in if I have an answer for you. Otherwise, I won't put it in. I would talk to you about it. The other thing in terms of balance, we talked about having the scriptural balance from day one of the truth and the Spirit, or the love of God, as well as balancing, worshiping Him in spirit and in truth. Hopefully we've done that. So far, we have balanced on what John has balanced as far as the truth of God, and we want to focus on the love of God and what he intended by the application of that love in the next two classes. So the first day we looked at the balancing of it, today, yesterday and today is the truth. Tomorrow is relating to love and how we apply that truth that is in our elder brother and promised seed that we've been considering this morning. So as you've rattled around in your head what I've considered for you in relationship to Antichrist, let's go back and read just a few references in John. If you want to turn up John, the first chapter, and read verse 14 again, and hopefully you'll see that this makes much more sense when he refers to, when John is referring to flesh, what did he mean? And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth, that balance that we're trying to strike consistently as we walk in our probation. Verse 13 says, just by way of contrasting the two, which were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. So it shows that God was the provider of this seed of the woman that was promised, that we hoped to be a part of, and we certainly can. Now let's go over to the first epistle of John, and we'll read a couple of verses there before we close. Now we're kind of looking at John's epistle in a broken way. It's broken up a bit, but we spent some time on really in chapter 2 from verses 15 through 26. And I'll remind you, one of the purposes there was in verse 26, "These things I have written to you concerning them that seduce you." So that is definitely something that we have to consider as to why he was writing what he wrote. And he says in verse 17, "And the world passes away, and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. Little children, it is the last time that ye have heard that Antichrist shall come. Even now there are many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if had they been of us, they would no doubt have continued with us, but when they went out, that they might be made manifest that they were not all of us." Verse 22 says, "Who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ, the Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son?" So he's trying to guard against those who are saying, "Well, I believe in God, but I don't accept Christ for who he is." "Whosoever denieth the Son, the same hath not the Father, but he acknowledges the Son and hath the Father also." Verse 24, "Let that therefore abide in you which ye have heard from the beginning." And that's the beginning that we talked about yesterday. "If that which ye have heard from the beginning shall remain in you, and you shall continue in the Son and in the Father. And this is the promise that he hath promised us, even eternal life," or that life that was promised in the Garden of Eden. And if you jump over one more chapter, two chapters, to the fourth chapter, we see that this same idea, John comes back to things in a cyclical manner. So, and that's why some people have a hard time understanding him. He doesn't always complete the thought. He comes back to it. And here he's talking about this idea of needing to understand the difference between the two spirits that are out there. "Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Hereby we know the Spirit of God, and every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it should come, and even now already is in the world. We are of God, little children," that term of affection that we talked about yesterday, "and have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. They are of the world, therefore they speak they of the world, that the world and the world heareth them, but we are of God, and he that knoweth God hears us, and knows, and that is not God appeareth," I'm sorry, "and he that is not of God heareth not us. Hereby we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." So that's that line that John is consistently trying to draw for us. And we'll finish by reading the next verse. "Beloved, let us love one another, for the love of God for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God."